I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush said today it's going to take a while for his financial rescue plan to work, and that's becoming clear. The Dow Jones Industrials plunged today, falling below the 10,000 level for the first time since 2004. Despite a series of announcements this morning from the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury to try to shore up confidence, the Federal Reserve, the central bank, will for the first time ever begin paying interest on money that banks keep with the reserve, a move meant to encourage banks to keep their money at the Fed. And the government will also begin to infuse billions of dollars of cash into troubled banks through existing loans. Well, does that mean your bank? And which is your bank as the giants gobble each other up? And what do these takeovers mean for the future of banking? John Cassidy is one of the country's leading business journalists. He's staff writer at The New Yorker. He writes the monthly economics column for Condé Nast Portfolio Magazine. John, welcome back to the program. We really need you today.
Thanks for inviting me on. Glad to be here.
Well, let's start with the volatility on Wall Street. Some people might be saying, why is the Dow dropping? The bailout bill was passed.
Well, I think people on Wall Street had a bit of a shock when they realized that even though the bill had been passed, the actual buying of assets, which it involves, not going to take place for at least another month or so. And a lot of the banks, you know, need money quickly. And I think people thought that the bailout would lead to an immediate infusion of cash.
And these assets...
Now it's not clear when the cash is going to start flowing.
Right. The government plans to buy up all these bad assets, including these bundled bad mortgage loans. But today they announced this infusion of cash into banks. Part of the regular business that Feds do with banks, they're boosting it, though. Is that correct?
Well, there's two different things. I mean, there's the bailout package, which was passed, obviously, at the end of last week. Under that program, the Treasury Department will start to buy mortgage assets off the banks. These are the assets which have been at the center of the problem since the crisis started last year. And as you say, they're basically bundled mortgages. But that's not going to happen for another month or so. So in the interim, the Fed, which lends to banks on an ongoing basis, has just stepped up its lending programs today. That's nothing new. They've just increased the size of the programs. And it doesn't seem to have been enough to restore confidence.
The hope was that it would at least free up some credit and infuse more cash into the system. Has that happened?
Well, not really. No, I mean, the Fed's been lending like this for at least a year now. Banks don't like to borrow from the Federal Reserve because it's a sign that they're in trouble and they can't raise money anywhere else. But the Fed has been relaxing the terms under which it lends to banks and increasing the amounts of money it's been making available. As I say, for months now, this is just another incremental move in that direction. So it wasn't anything radical enough to make Wall Street, you know, people's opinions change about the situation on Wall Street.
Well, and there's another thing that's very confusing for people. We've started loosely talking about banks, and it's become more of an umbrella reference to every place where there is money.
Right.
So put this in context. The big investment houses that didn't fail last week converted to banks, and that gives them more government oversight, but again, more government backing, which they desperately need. So maybe this is a stupid question, but this idea of infusing banks with cash, are they talking about a bank where we might have a checking account? Are they talking about Goldman Sachs?
Well, I think, you know, as you said, there's a lot of confusion. There's basically two types of banks. There's the old-fashioned investment banks like Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers, which doesn't exist anymore, and Bear Stearns, which doesn't exist anymore. They basically were in the business of buying and selling securities. They didn't have customer accounts. Then there are regular banks, which most people think of as banks, that you see on your high street corner, like Citigroup or JP Morgan Chase or Wachovia. They're called commercial banks. Now, for 30 or 40 years, they were very separate, but in the last 10 years, they've started to join together. And in the last couple of months, since the financial crisis intensified, the commercial banks have basically taken over all of the investment banks, bar two, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. And even they have converted themselves into commercial banks by opening commercial banking subsidiaries, which, as you say, gives them access to more funding from the Fed if necessary. So the old distinction between Wall Street and commercial banks has disappeared, basically.
Well, and are there a few more categories? I mean, what about the independent banks?
Go ahead. Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a lot of local community banks. I mean, historically, the American banking system has been very fragmented after the Great Depression. Laws were introduced to prevent banks expanding across state lines. So compared to the rest of the world, you know, it's very unusual. There have been thousands of banks in the U.S. If you go to the U.K., which you can probably tell I originate from, there's only been four high street banks for a long time now. So part of what's happening is the American banking system is consolidating along a more European basis, and a lot of the small banks have been bought out by the bigger banks, and some of the bigger banks have been bought out by the even bigger banks. I mean, the takeover of Wachovia, which is going through at the moment by either Citigroup or Wells Fargo, you know, will create an enormous bank. So things are changing very rapidly in the banking system because of the crisis.
Well, a couple questions there. I mean, everything you say, you know, provokes about five questions. So we want to try to get them all to you. I'm just staying with the independent banks for a minute. I misspoke last week on the program. I said that all mortgages are sold. They're not. I know that. And Larry DeJong of Ashland, Massachusetts, wrote to say that in fact, he found an independent bank that promised that it wouldn't sell his mortgage after his was sold several times. And one of the buyers neglected to pay some of his fees, and he got in trouble. So Larry points out that there are small banks, in fact, I remember I have one as well, that promise not to resell your mortgage. Are those banks also in credit trouble, even if they have, you know, absolutely clean mortgages with people who are paying their mortgages?
It depends what type of mortgages they've been extending. I mean, some of the older, more traditional banks didn't get into subprime lending, which is lending to people with troubled credit histories. Most of the banks which just stuck to their knitting and just lent to people with high-grade credit histories are in reasonable shape. The delinquencies have gone up, but they're nothing radical. I think it's like 2 or 3% now. So those banks are in pretty good shape. But a lot of banks which, even though they kept the mortgages on their books, did expand into subprime lending because that was seen as the great growth area. So there are a lot of banks which still own the mortgages, but there are troubled mortgages. Now, under the bailout, they too are eligible for relief from the Treasury. So the Treasury doesn't only have the authority to buy mortgage securities, it can actually go and buy individual mortgages from the banks as well. But so that should help them. The problem is, as I say at the moment, nobody really knows how this program is going to work because the details haven't been published yet, and the Treasury itself, I don't think, has decided exactly how it's going to work.
Well,
there's just still a lot of uncertainty out there. And the problem is that, you know, banks are very fragile institutions. They have to raise money every day, so we've got the next month or so of, you know, of big trouble if confidence isn't restored.
Well, I was going to say, your small independent bank with a banker that you know may be doing just fine until he or she can't get the credit that banks need to get from other banks.
Right. Well, you see, the thing, most people don't really understand how banks work. Banks have to raise money pretty much every day or every other day in what's called the overnight money markets. Because if you think about it, you know, when they take money, they take your deposits and put them in when you just put it into the bank, and then they lend it to people, to firms, or they buy securities. They basically lend it on a long-term basis. And they lend more than the individual deposits, and the balance is made up by borrowing. They borrow in the overnight markets. Mm-hmm. So if they're sources of borrowing dry up, i.e. lenders just won't give any more credit to the individual banks, banks can just go down like a stack of cards, and that's what we've started to see. The system is inherently fragile and depends on confidence in the underlying credit, which most of the time is there because, you know, most of the time people think that people are going to repair their loans, and most people do repair their loans. But once confidence disappears, it's very hard to restore, and that's what we're finding at the moment. Rather than lending to somebody who you don't know whether they're going to pay back or whether somebody else isn't going to pay them back, there's a sort of chain of illogic here. And what happens is that nobody lends to anybody, and the credit market seizes up. The only people who are willing to lend are the government, and that's what's happening. The Fed is basically the lender of the last resort at the moment.
Well, John Cassidy, just want to check on one other thing you just said. We've talked about it on the program, but I think it's worth repeating. You said part of the problem for any bank, whether they're independent or not, is if they got into subprime loans, a lot of these variable interest rate loans that shot up, people who maybe shouldn't have qualified for loans. But 60 Minutes last night did a terrific job putting together a lot of the problem. And they pointed out, they remind us, that only 6% of Americans have been defaulting on their mortgages. 94% of Americans pay their mortgages. The problem is that the investment houses began selling insurance on those mortgages, guaranteeing bad mortgages. And then, of course, when the mortgages started to fail, it's exponentially increased the problem because they were selling insurance on it.
Right.
Is that something that's going to be eliminated? To me, that feels like if somebody goes, I mean, the stock market was supposed to be about risk. And if, you know, too many bad risks and you moved on or got out. It's sort of like selling insurance for someone to go to Las Vegas, isn't it?
Well, I mean, they're basically buying insurance on bonds, is what it is. The investment banks bundle the mortgage into bonds, which they then sell to somebody. And the person who buys them, you know, then owns the bond, has always got what is called a credit risk, which is the risk that the underlying mortgages won't be repaid. So what happened is insurance companies like AIG and banks like Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan and all sorts of other people started selling insurance policies on these bonds, which are called credit default swaps, which is a misnomer. They're not really anything to do with swaps. They're just insurance policies.
Right.
So and that seemed quite legitimate at the time. The problem was that they were underpriced because everybody assumed that even the subprime buyers wouldn't default. It's just like underpricing catastrophe insurance. If you think about insuring, if you're an insurance company and you set up on the Florida coast and started selling very cheap hurricane insurance, and then you had a series of bad storms, you know, the insurance company would very quickly get into trouble because it would be faced with a lot bigger claims than it expected. And that's what's happened in this case. The storm is the subprime crisis, so all the people who sold insurance are faced with bigger claims than they thought. Mm. AIG is the classic example, and, you know, they were in such bad shape that the government had to bail them out.
So again, a little more of this cat's cradle of the banking industry, everything sort of woven together. There are over 8,000 banks in the country today. What do you think is going to happen? What kind of contraction of banking are we looking at?
Well, there's two things going on. One, there's just a cyclical downsizing, which is quite necessary. In the last 15 years, we've had an enormous credit boom, and the financial industry basically got far too big for its boots. Historically, the financial industry accounts for 10, maybe 15% of the entire economy in terms of profits. By 2004, 2005, it was up to 35, 40%. And that was largely people just shuffling paper to each other and booking them as profits because there was a credit boom and everything was going up. Stocks were going up. The price of houses was going up. Price of bonds was going up. So it's just very easy to make money in the financial sector. That's obviously reversed itself. So a lot of the expansion, which was basically a false expansion in the last 10 years, is now being wiped out. I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with that. It was, as they say, it was a sort of false expansion to begin with. Then there's a second process going on, which I mentioned earlier, which is that the American banking industry historically was very fragmented, and that is now changing rapidly. We're seeing the emergence of these enormous banking conglomerates like Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Chase. So those two things together add up to a big contraction in the banking industry.
And what does it mean if banks are larger than they were 20 years ago when we saw the S&L crisis? What does it mean when banks fail? What is the future of banking? What might it look like? And John Cassidy, you were talking about how, you know, some of the banks currently in this country out of 8,000 might fail, and some of that might be a good shakeout. But how is it different from the savings and loans crisis where so many banks had to close? How is it different today?
Well, I mean, obviously there's some similarities in that a lot of the banks have just got a lot of bad assets on their books, which is exactly was the case in the 1980s, and a lot of them are real estate related, which was also true in the 1980s. So that's one similarity, and a lot of them will end up going broke, like as happened in the 1980s. They were then the thrifts rather than regular banks, but now it's all sorts of banks in trouble. Some of the differences are that the government response is different this time. Back in when they set up the Resolution Trust Corporation in the late 80s, that basically waited until the banks went broke and then took over their assets. This time the government is trying to head off a mass collapse of banks by setting up this bailout to bail out ongoing concerns. There's a lot of controversy about that. Some people think they shouldn't bail the banks out until they're already broke, which would wipe out the shareholders. But this time, the Fed and the Treasury, as I say, are trying to head off a sort of mass collapse, as you saw in the S&L sector.
Well, how about this quote in the Associated Press today? It's the kind of thing you don't think you're going to see until there's dark clouds like the ones that we have gathering. They quote a depositor walking by a bank saying, "It sounds like a joke, but I'm wondering, is now the time to put my money in a mattress rather than in a bank account?" How does this impact the average, you know, person with a checking account?
Right. right. I mean, I made a joke about that myself last week, saying maybe it's time to buy gold or put your money under a mattress in one of the pieces I wrote. But, I mean, I was only joking. The fact is now, after the bailout, that all deposits are federally insured up to $250,000. Most people don't have more than $250,000 in the bank. So
but can they be covered? Can they be covered? Can the FDIC cover that?
Of course they can be covered. The government's got the, you know, if necessary, the government can print money to pay it, to pay people out. The government's not like a firm. It can't go bankrupt. So, unless there's mass hysteria. And even if there's mass hysteria, the hysterical people will eventually get paid out when the government gets around to paying them. So I really think, you know, that is overstating the case to say that people are going to be queuing up at the banks like they were in the 30s. There was no deposit insurance then. Now there's deposit insurance. Right. We saw a run on the banks in the UK, at Northern Rock last year, when people started lining up outside the banks, but that was because there was no deposit insurance in the UK. There is deposit insurance in the US guaranteed by the government, and it's just been increased from 100,000 to 250,000.
John Cassidy, you were writing about exactly this scenario. In fact, we spoke to you last February. I mean, it's just word for word, and I'll link it to our website for people who'd like to read it. Given that people like you could see the path that we're now going down, we're now hearing huge bankers saying, how could anyone have known? How much legal fallout do you think, criminal fallout, do you think there will be?
Well, there's two issues. One is whether the banks themselves, whether there was any sort of criminal or illegal conduct inside the banks in marketing some of these securities to people. The SEC and the FBI are looking into that now. I don't really have a view on that. I mean, I think a lot of it was gullibility rather than outright criminality. The second aspect of it is whether the government could have moved earlier to have some sort of a bailout. I've been doing some reporting on this topic, and if you talk to people in the Fed and the Treasury, what they say is that, sure, some of us thought that this might eventually be the outcome, but there's no way we could have gone to Congress months and months ago and asked for a big bailout of the banking industry. There wouldn't have been any political support for it. And I think that is true. The only time it's very controversial bailing out banks, understandably, who wants to give money to rich guys on Wall Street? But the only way you can actually do it is when there's an absolute crisis and people are so frightened that they go along with it. And that's effectively what we've seen in the last 2 weeks.
John Cassidy, staff writer at The New Yorker. He also writes the monthly economics column for Condé Nast Portfolio Magazine. John, thanks as always.
Thank you very much indeed.
Well, lawmakers want to find out what went wrong with the financial system. Today, the House Oversight Committee held a hearing into Lehman Brothers. Lehman's CEO, Richard Fuld, will be testifying. The 158-year-old investment bank was not bailed out when it declared bankruptcy last month, but it set off a chain reaction across Wall Street. And today, Democratic Congressman Henry Waxman said Fuld and others need to take responsibility for the massive failures on Wall Street. He criticized Fuld for large CEO salaries.
What's fundamentally unfair about the collapse of Lehman is its impact on the economy and taxpayers. Mr. Fuld will do fine. He can walk away from Lehman, a wealthy man who earned over $500 million. But taxpayers are left with a $700 billion bill to rescue Wall Street and an economy in crisis.
Benton Ives of Congressional Quarterly is covering today's hearings. Benton Fuld himself says what happened is an absolute tragedy. But how are congressmen and lawmakers going to square that with reports we're hearing, one in the Wall Street Journal, that Lehman executives knew how much capital they needed? They knew they were in trouble when they made a phone call in September to investors and said that there was no problem.
I think that gets to the heart of today's hearings and some of the other hearings we're going to have going forward. I think there's a lot of doubt in lawmakers' mind about how forthcoming some of these banks were about their fiscal health during this whole crisis. Now, of course, that is part of the nature of the business. You know, I mean, the bank is attempting to shop itself, and it doesn't necessarily want investors and shareholders to run for the exits. If they were to reveal that they were shopping around some of these more hard to get rid of assets.
Well, and Lehman Brothers also has a complaint that the government didn't bail them out, but bailed others out.
I think that they do have a complaint there. It's pretty clear that Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke were probably trying to draw a line in the sand with Lehman. They'd already gone in to rescue Bear Stearns. They'd gone into bed with Fannie and Freddie, and now they were trying to pull back and say, you know, no, we're going to we're going to put a stop to some of these bailouts.
Well, and on the issue of executive pay, Henry Waxman said that while the CEO was asking the government to save the bank, the Executive Compensation Board was advising huge compensation salaries, bonuses for executives. That's sure to come up today as well. Benton Ives of Congressional Quarterly. Benton, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Okay, still ahead, as if you didn't have enough of a headache. What if there is a tie in the Electoral College in the presidential race? It could happen after the news here and now. The headline from the presidential trails is that both campaigns are lobbying accusations at each other. But what we thought was of interest is that Sarah Palin chose to make comments about Barack Obama at a rally in Nebraska yesterday. Nebraska, why did she bother? That state has consistently voted Republican, which is why it's also curious that Barack Obama is focusing on the state as well. The answer is that Nebraska is one of two states that can split its electoral college votes. And according to the Washington Post, both campaigns see the possibility that even one electoral vote might make the difference in this race if John McCain and Barack Obama emerge with an electoral college tie. Now, as we learned in the 2000 campaign, it's not the popular vote that picks the president. It's the Electoral College. And analysts are posing this scenario. What if there is a tie? And to break it, the democratically controlled House, which decides the presidency in a tie, picks Obama, but the Republican controlled Senate, which picks the VP, picks Sarah Palin, Obama Palin. Dr. Judith Best, professor of political science and an Electoral College specialist at the State University of New York in Cortland. Judy, we understand that many analysts are putting forth this possibility.
Well, yes. I don't think that it is something that is likely, but it's possible.
Well, let's back up and remind ourselves why. A quick primer on the Electoral College, your specialty. Each state has a set number of electors. And remind us, how is that number reached?
Each state has as many electors as it has representatives in the whole Congress. So since each state has two senators and at least one member of the House, the minimum number is three. But if you have more members of the House, California has 55 electors. The whole thing was set up to be a surrogate Congress. The Electoral College exists for one day. It's a nice job if you can get it, because you only work one day every 4 years. And then it has no more power, and so the president is chosen.
Well, who are these electors? Do they, how do they get elected to be electors?
Well, they are members, loyal members of the party. They're usually state chairman and county and committee chairman. These are loyal party activists who are, in many states, are pledged to support they're pledged to support the electors of their party. On certain ballots, it will say just the name of the candidate, let's say Obama or McCain. But in small print, it will say, for the electors of.
Huh.
And in a few states, there used to be states that listed the electors. And, of course, they'd probably have to be small states.
Right. Couldn't be California.
They only have 55 names on a ballot.
Right. Well, let's go back to California again. As we said, it has 55 electors. How does it work? Let's say Obama wins the popular vote, as he's expected to do. His 55 electors
are elected. So the Republican electors are not chosen.
If California is known as a winner-take-all state, which states are not winner-take-all?
There are only two, Maine and Nebraska. However, they've never split. They're so small and homogeneous that they've never split their votes. But all the rest of the states have winner-take-all or first-past-the-post. Whoever gets the most popular votes, that candidate's electors are elected.
Right. And that brings us back to the idea of a tie. Now, according to the websites that crunch the Electoral College numbers, there are about 128 trillion ways that Electoral College voting could end in a tie. But politically, only a few scenarios are realistic, and they depend on which candidate wins the battleground states or flips states from another party's column into his party column. But a tie could happen. Now, what happens if there is a tie? What does the law say about what the Senate or the House do in that case?
Right. What's important is the Constitution has created a series of tiebreakers. First, if there were a tie, there would be a contingency election in the House of Representatives, and it chooses among the three top electoral vote winners. only electoral vote winners. So, for example, Perot, who didn't win any electoral votes, wouldn't have been considered when he ran.
And in the House, each state has one vote.
Has one vote, and if a state is tied, then they lose their vote. If that fails, then the next contingency is that the Senate chooses the vice president from the two top electoral vote winners, and he would serve as president until the House got its act together and chose a president. And if the Senate failed, then there is another solution. And so we have listed the order of succession. First, the Speaker of the House would serve as acting president. If the Speaker doesn't qualify or refuses to resign from the House, has to resign from the position, then it's the president pro tempore of the Senate, who is the longest-serving member of the majority party in the Senate. And if that fails, then there is the cabinet in order of rank. And the rank order of the cabinet is based upon the date when Congress created that cabinet office.
We understand the Secretary of Agriculture would get a shot at it before the Department of Homeland Security would.
That's exactly right.
We understand in the Senate, where every senator has one vote, again, in a contingency election for vice president, should there be an electoral college tie, that if there's a tie in the Senate, that the vice president would step in to break the tie, and that would be Dick Cheney?
That is correct, because his term doesn't end until January 20th.
And there you have the scenario that a democratically controlled House might pick Barack Obama in the event of a tie, but a Republican-controlled Senate or a Senate that ties might pick Sarah Palin if Dick Cheney had to come in and break that tie.
Yes.
Do you think it's possible?
It's possible. I don't think it's likely.
Do you think the Electoral College system works?
By and large, it does. So far, it beats all the alternatives. There are some things that could be done to improve it, abolish the office of elector, and have the governor of the state cast the electoral votes based on the popular vote. That would certainly improve it. And I personally would change the contingency election in the House. This would allow every member of the House to cast a vote. It wouldn't be one vote per state. It would be every one of the 435 would cast their own vote for the president. Mm-hmm. And so it would truly be a surrogate Congress. Mm-hmm. Those are the two changes I would make. But to abandon it in presidential elections could make the president a kind of Caesar. He could claim to be a more authentic voice than the Senate or even the House. And so it would change the balance of power in the government. I mean, we're talking about a whole solar system of governmental power here. That's what John Kennedy called it. And he said if we're going to consider a fundamental change in one part of it, we have to consider them all. And so I think that an all-national vote is highly undesirable.
Dr. Judith Best, professor of political science at the State University of New York in Cortland. Thanks so much for talking us through this. Thank you.
You're most welcome.
Okay, before we go today, remember Ani DiFranco, the original Maverick. You're listening to Here and Now.
Come on, Bob. It's just a windshield wiper.
To you, maybe. To that bartender up there, but to me, it's the Mona Lisa.
That's a scene from the new film Flash of Genius, the story of Detroit inventor Bob Kearns, whose Mona Lisa was the intermittent windshield wiper, his invention that was stolen by the car industry. After a lengthy and costly legal battle with the Ford Motor Company, Kearns got credit and cash. But was real life like the movie? We called Bob Kearns' oldest son, Dennis. Now, if you saw the film, Dennis helps his dad at trial, but he also, in real life, became a detective and spent years hunting down evidence for his dad. But Dennis, before that, it was stomach-turning to watch your dad turn down settlement offers when you were little and your family could have used the money. Was that hard?
Well, I think, you know, there were certain aspects of it that were certainly difficult. I mean, money was always tight. You were always in the middle of constant warfare. you know, in the movie they show a few offers of money being made along the way, but in reality there weren't any offers of money from the time I was 10 years old until I was 40 years old.
Yeah, so this was a long period, much longer period of time than was depicted in the film.
Yes, they brought it down to about 12 years in the film, but in actuality, my dad invented the device November of 63, the week John Kennedy was actually assassinated, and then we first went to trial with Ford in 91.
In the film, you're depicted as a son who just really gets irritated with your dad. The family seemed golden in the way that a lot did in the, you know, in the 50s, and then it's shattered by this one man's determination to not get money, but to clear his name and to get justice for inventors. As a kid, did you get that, or were you like, gosh, it's more important to keep our family together? I mean, what was your thought?
Well, no, I think in the movie they added a lot of that for dramatic effect. In fact, my dad paid for me to go to get a Jesuit education at a Jesuit high school in Detroit, and Jesuits have a tendency to teach you about ideals. So I was molded in that same pattern.
Your mom is portrayed in the film as someone who really had to hold a large family together, who was the love of your father's life, and yet just couldn't take it after a while. Was that true to life?
Yeah, I think to a large extent that was very true. At the same time, I don't think her love for him ever diminished either. She was involved for a long, long time, and at a point, you know, finally decided it just wasn't working for her. And later on, when my dad was older and, you know, in ill health towards the end of his life, she was there with him and spent probably the last, I'm not sure whether it was a month or 2 months with him, you know, helping him out in the nursing home there until he died in February of 2005.
Huh. Well, given how difficult it was for your mom and how difficult it was, you know, for the family. Now, you've said, yes, you know, raised by Jesuits, and you were very much behind the, you know, the idea of getting justice. But, and it certainly became, you know, financially worth it for the family, without giving away too much of the ending. But really, was it worth it?
Well, it wasn't financially worth it for the family, no. But it was, it made the world a better place.
Well, ultimately, wasn't it financially worth it for the family? Or?
We ended up with some money. The attorneys got the bulk of it. The IRS death tax, you know, got half of what was left. You know, I mean, it's not enough to make our lives change. It's not like any of my brothers and sisters or I can't stop going to work.
Well, this is quite something. But you said, and I don't want to lose that thought, that ultimately there a greater goal was achieved.
From 1978, when we started the lawsuits, through 1991, when we went to trial with Ford, the most the automotive industry had ever paid anybody for an invention was 11 cents a unit. By the time we went to trial with Chrysler a few years later, inventors were coming up thanking my father profusely, saying, "They're giving me $2 a unit now." My dad never saw $2 a unit, but the world has, and it's probably a higher figure now, and it was because somebody finally had the intestinal fortitude to stand up and show them that what normally worked in the past doesn't always work when you find somebody that's a little eccentric.
That's Dennis Kearns, the story of his father's legal battle with the Ford Motor Company and other motor companies over his windshield wiper design is portrayed in the new film Flash of Genius. He's been speaking to us from Keego Harbor, Michigan. Dennis, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Robin. Appreciate it.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Squint your eyes and look closer. I'm not between you and your ambition. I am a poster girl with no poster. I am 32 flavors and then some.
That's 32 Flavors from Ani DiFranco, the well-known feminist icon and maverick recording artist. She received the Women of Courage Award from NOW, the National Organization for Women, for her stand on issues like gay and reproductive rights. And it's true, if she was angry about social injustice, Ani DiFranco put it in a song.
White people are so scared of black people. They bulldoze out to the country and put up houses on little loopy-loop streets while America gets it.
She also founded her own independent music label, Righteous Babe Records, and based it in her hometown of Buffalo, New York, thumbing her nose at the music industry. But now, Ani has relocated to New Orleans, and there are some other changes in her life as well.
But now, here's this tiny baby, and they say she looks just like me. And she is smiling at me with a present infant glee.
That's Present Infant from Ani DiFranco's new CD, Red Letter Year, her first CD since becoming a mother, and she joins us from public radio station KWMU in St. Louis, Missouri. Ani, welcome.
Hi.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, as you know, reviewers are saying, you know, that your new CD, Red Letter Year, is more relaxed, it's a more carefree, joyous Ani DiFranco. Do you think that's right? Do you think they've got it right?
Yeah, I've definitely been my happier self again lately, you know, what with my new family and a new baby and new place to live, New Orleans that I love, and new band, a lot of good new developments in my little life.
Well, you know, I wanted you to say it because I didn't want to just be presumptuous and say, here's a woman who's happier after she had a baby because, you know, but you're saying that.
Yeah, sure. Actually, you know, I got to give all the props, though, to her father, who I think, you know, of all of the answer, you know, people have been asking me lately, what is this red letter year? What's so special? And, you know, and it really all emanates out from him. I think, you know, I was just blessed with finding my true love, and all of these good developments kind of emanated out from that.
This is Mike Napolitano. And by the way, you say it's your daughter's father. We heard you call him the baby daddy.
Baby daddy.
instead of husband or partner, right?
Or co-producer.
And he is that as well. He's co-producer of your records. Well, let's listen to this feeling that you're expressing in the song Smiling Underneath.
We could be stuck in traffic for all.
Congratulations. Who doesn't want to, you know, feel better on life? But first of all, we rush to say it's not like you've gone soft. You still say that George Bush has a monkey face and basically blame him for the failed response to Katrina in one of your songs. I mean, you still have got some issues that you take up.
Yeah, somebody asked me the other day, well, so I guess you're less pointedly political now that you're a mother. And I was thinking of that song, All of This, on the new record.
Like, right.
I won't pray to a male god, and I can't support the troops. Sorry, am I mincing words?
So Ani DiFranco is still with us. she hasn't disappeared.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, but you know, I'm wondering about a part of you that has changed. Let's listen to another song on the new CD, Emancipated Minor.
So she attended the dance classes, and she learned the little dance, and she tried the high heels, but she couldn't bring herself to prance. All the while, a faint ticking in the silence between the songs.
Now, who is this woman you're singing about?
Well, I guess it's maybe the younger me, just from a sort of a an older, safer position. You know, I'm past my horny youth, happily. You know, I'm in a monogamous relationship, happily, of my own choosing.
And you don't envy that former you.
Yeah, you know, it's a tall order, I think, to be any young person exploring their sexuality and becoming themselves. But I think especially for young women, and it was just that song is kind of a reflection on the peril of exploring the world with a reproductive system in your gut. So, you know, good luck.
Yeah. So some autobiography in Emancipated Minor, and definitely some in the song The Atom. You mentioned that your great-great-uncle helped develop the first atomic bomb. He won a Nobel Prize in Physics. This, of course, was the bomb dropped on Japan during World War II. What brought you to sing about this?
Honestly, that song was born after a day of lobbying. I spent a day on Capitol Hill, and amongst these people who all really like to get their God on these days. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up with the idea that the separation of church and state was a fundamental precept of our nation. And this song, The Atom, you know, I think about if you're interested in preserving God's creation, what more fundamental creation than the atom? You know, the unifying design of the universe.
You're messing with the atom is the highest form of blasphemy. Whether you are making weapons or simply electricity, someone fashion me a puppet. I have been called to engage with the maniacal heretics of the nuclear age.
That's Ani DeFranco, and we want to go out with the last song on your CD. It's Red Letter Year Reprise, a joyous, you know, jam featuring the Rebirth Brass Band. Is that about you, New Orleans? What is that?
Yes, both. It's it's very much, I mean, the Rebirth is, they are, you know, like the mayors of New Orleans. You know, they're one of the oldest brass bands. So, yeah, the album ends with the song Red Letter Year played in their style, in the second line style.
Well, we'll listen to that as we say thank you so much, Ani DeFranco. Again, the new CD, Red Letter Year. Thanks.
Thank you.